Thank you, Julia. On behalf of everybody at the Law Centre, I'd like to thank you very much for your very impassioned and very compelling address to us tonight. And I would also like just to take this moment to thank the Harbour Commissioner's Office for the use of this splendid room, which has been referred to on more than one occasion already this evening. Poverty is real and it is damaging, but as Julia said, or should I say, and it is not inevitable. It's not a but, it's and it is not inevitable. Julia has suggested a new organising principle, a new organising purpose to the work that all of us in this room are engaged in. She has captured the full range and the complex range, the web that consists of the experience of poverty and the web of strategies that need to be put in place and actions that need to be delivered in order to eradicate poverty. The new, strong and just social settlement that Julia talked about perhaps gives us the opening into now moving into an opportunity for you to suggest where you see the opportunities and where you see the potentials, because Julia talked about three P's: the pockets, the prospects and the place. And I'm delighted to hear you talk about the place, because that's so important, so critically important. So what's the potential? We have a number of people in this room whose direct experience is in working on issues of poverty and social exclusion. So we have a fantastic opportunity now with Julia, and I'm going to take questions from the floor. In doing so, could I ask you please to identify who you are, not who you're from, who you are, and if you are coming from an organisation, just perhaps to tell us who that organisation is. And I didn't do that introducing myself. I'm Ursula Hare from the Law Centre.
I expect to do that.
Thank you, Julia. Okay, so any questions? And there is a roving mic in the room.
I may sit down later. You'll have to ask me one.
I'm going to Les Allaby from the Human Rights Commission.
I thought I'd better ask the first question. This is an audience of shy, retiring violets. Julia, I wanted to ask you about where you think the role of tax justice might play in this new social settlement. And I'm struck by the summer budget was a game changer in terms of the social security system and for working age families, both in and out of work. And I say that because I think universal credit had a rationale: make work pay and make the system more simple. I think both of those have been probably fatally holed below the waterline, in spite of the, when you look at this combined with the very positive kind of changes to the national minimum wage, it's clear that the making work pay is now completely fragmented. So that leaves us to where tax justice might play a role. And then secondly, your sense of where social security is going as a result of kind of what the summer budget has done to universal credit.
Thank you, Les. A good and challenging question. I bet other people have got views on this as well. I had one of those peculiar moments when the Chancellor stood up and he said, I want a high wage, low benefit, low tax economy. And I thought, well, two out of three isn't bad. I too would like a high wage, low benefit economy. My own view is we have to carry on paying tax, we have to collect the tax that is due, and we have to manage that much more effectively. If half of the resource that is put in to chasing benefit, so-called fraud or error, were put into dealing with collecting tax, we will be much better off. But that's a sort of glib response to that. I think the summer budget was game-changing for a number of reasons. I think they mean it. I think they believe that actually arguing for higher wages and reducing benefits at the same time is the way to get higher wages. I don't think that's right. We've argued from Joseph Rowntree Foundation that the sequencing is all wrong on this, that if wages can rise, and there's lots of economic reasons why they're not rising, if wages can rise, then the demand for tax credits tapers off. There will still be big demands for tax credits, for childcare, for all those additional costs people have because they have children. But working in-work tax credits would taper off. Instead, they're doing it the other way around, which seems to me to be a huge political gamble. And I don't know how it's playing out. I interrupted my own words to say they may be changing as I speak, because there's all sorts of rumours that they're going to. But tax justice needs to be at the heart of this, because we need to start doing what universal credit in its very brave early conception did, which is to see the tax and the system of social security as one. And at Joseph Rowntree Foundation, when we first started hearing about universal credit, I think it was then called dynamic benefits, 2008, 2009, I remember thinking, looks interesting. And I remember commissioning some work about it, and the response came back, it is really interesting. It could really work. It would be very, very expensive. And you wouldn't do it at a time when the labour market was a bit precarious. It's been introduced in such a way in Great Britain, which is stop-start, poorly introduced, introduced only for some people at a time. We have no way of knowing whether universal credit is in any fit shape to do that task. I would argue for a reset of universal credit, because that's the only way to make tax credits and benefits align.
It's a two for one on commissioners. Kuli Yasuma from Nikki. It's just really a follow-on about tax justice. When the Chancellor announced the changes to the tax credit system and the living wage, there was a little, like you, I had the same reaction. Oh, that looks good. And like you, your organisation, because the first thing I did is I went to your website, I thought, right, what does Rowntree think about this before I make a statement? And it took a couple of days for me to work out, do the figures. Why has it taken everybody else 3.5 months to get all hot and bothered about the likely impact of the changes in tax credits and the disconnect between the raising of the living wage? Why has it taken everybody else 3.5 months? What's your thinking about that?
Well, a bit of me thinks maybe we're hopeless because we've been saying this for 3.5 months and now it's come to the top of the agenda. I think a number of things. I think in talking about poverty, we have to be absolutely focused on what the figures and the data tell us. And I'm delighted you went to the Joseph Rowntree Foundation website, because the thing we've tried to do is make that as accessible as possible. But we also know there is this barrage of resistance to hearing it. And somebody much cleverer than me once said, it's only when you bored yourself with talking about it that they're beginning to listen. And I have spent the last month at various party political conferences and in Manchester at the Conservative Party conference. I thought they're beginning to listen. They're beginning to hear it. We carry on saying it and saying it, but maybe we have to learn to say it better. But I don't know what the answer is to that, because I think we've been saying it as strongly as we can. £1,300 a year in the pockets of some of the poorest families in the UK is what we're facing. And when a Conservative MP, who I won't name, but I'd love to, said it's only about £25 a week, I knew that the dialogue of the deaf was going on, and we had to start talking about this differently. Because, yes, he's right. It is about that, and that's the difference between make or break.
Adrian Gilkey from Queen's University. Just want to sort of take a more broadly political view, comparative political view on this. The famous witticism of Republicans in the United States that LBJ waged a war on poverty and poverty won. In other words, that there's a limit to what governments can do, and the kind of attitude that that government isn't what the important in relationship to the fight against poverty. Other things are, by implication, entrepreneurs, businesses, and so on. Obviously, we've been talking about tax, which that doesn't apply to, but what's your, how do you see the more broadly philosophical point that the right make on this, and how do you respond to it?
I can talk for too long about LBJ's war on poverty, and I promise you I won't. But LBJ Johnson declared war on poverty, and the right will always tell you that poverty won. But actually, the figures went in the right way. It was long-term sustained effort, which made a difference. Now, of course, it didn't eradicate poverty from the United States. There is still shocking poverty, but it made a difference. And what they did in that programme was they did the stuff we know we need to do about income transfers. We do need to get some money into the pockets of people who are poor. But they also built strong institutions. And they operated at every level of federal and then the state. They involved churches and organisations. And over a very long period of time, they made a difference to those numbers. I think it's become easy to say, poverty one in the United States, because of course, in the end, global forces trumped a lot of that. But what would have happened if he hadn't launched that long-term sustained campaign is anybody's guess. In the United States, race is patterned on poverty now in a way that I think in this country disability is beginning to be. It's much you are much, much more likely to be poor if you are disabled in this country, just as in the United States, race has done that. So in terms of what happened in the United States, let's not dismiss it, let's learn from it. In terms of where I think governments are fantastically important in what happens in poverty, but I think for too long we've taken the view that until government leads, none of us can do anything. Whereas actually, I think one of the things we've learned is that governments are also affected by how others lead and how others do things, which is the reason I talk about the multiple actors in this. I think there are governments, UK, Scotland, Wales, Northern Ireland. There are the cities of the UK and the cities across the UK, which have huge powers in terms of economic development. There are communities and neighbourhoods, and at each of those levels, there are different things that can be done. Housing associations can, without permission from government, start doing things to get their tenants out of poverty. Companies can, without permission, start looking at their HR policies. Local authorities can change their procurement approaches. We can, if we treat this as an organising purpose, work together to do things about it. Of course, government matters. The redistributive role of government is critical. But I think I want to redress the balance and stop waiting for government to say it's all right to do this. I think we know how to do some of it ourselves.
Thank you. Just here.
Claire McKeown, I'm the Sustainable Development Manager at Belfast City Council. I want to thank you for a really, really fabulous lecture. I thought that was great. I'm working on fuel poverty and food poverty in the city at the moment, and it is a really, really difficult problem to solve. You probably know that we're sitting at 42% fuel poverty in Belfast, which is probably one of the highest levels in the UK. It's a particularly difficult problem because we're so oil-dependent for space heating. So I'm wondering if you have any solutions in terms of radical solutions like energy cooperatives, community energy cooperatives. I know the big energy companies in the UK have been taken on by both the government and community cooperatives, and I'm wondering, can you share any of those examples with us? And
Okay.
It's particularly difficult because the oil price has fallen and is likely to stay as low as it is for the next year or two until globally issues level out. But it is something that's going to affect us even more, and it affects the amount of money in the economy ultimately, as well as the very fuel poor and the health problems that go with fuel poverty.
But isn't it disgraceful that people are still in fuel poverty, that keeping warm and dry in the way Glenn was described is still a challenge in the 21st century? It's quite hard to believe. And yet it also provides us with some of the potential for economic growth, because the green economy, which in so many parts of the world is attracting investment, is the best possible way to get houses dry, properly insulated, not using so much fuel, because actually it's reduction in demand in fuel that we need. We know that the poorest households will use the most expensive approach to fuel because their houses are much more likely to be drafty, poorly insulated and cold. We need to make our economic development focus on the green economy, which brings in jobs and can make people's houses safe. And at the same time, there are approaches, and I'm afraid I don't know any in Northern Ireland, I'm sure others will, but there are joint procurement approaches to fuel. There are states where people are using photovoltaics and trying to get fuel in differently. I think we have to treat this as a matter of investment and a matter of urgent investment, but both for the families who are living there, but also for the sake of the planet in the long term. And I think you mentioned food poverty. Many of the same arguments would go there. The big issue about how you buy food and the ways in which poorer people are cut out of the savings made possible is a very similar set of arguments.
Julia, can I ask a question? In response to the remark from LBJ about the war on poverty, you talked about there being a range of actors required to mobilise around this. But government is one actor, but a very important actor. You're speaking to us tonight at a time when there are a number of government-led strategies around childcare, around child poverty. Northern Ireland has particularly high childcare costs within the UK. I know Les will remember when Alison Garning came over from the Child Poverty Action Group some years ago and said, oh, you're where we were 10 years ago in terms of childcare provision and childcare costs. So there is opportunity, and there's opportunity now for leadership within at a government level in terms of implementing a range of strategies. What's your suggestion for how, because we talked about a web, or I talked about a web.
Yeah.
So who coordinates the web? How does it all come together? Where does the leadership come from that makes all of those bits of the jigsaw fit together?
What we're trying to do at Joseph Rowntree Foundation, and this is one of those things where, you know, very heroic is the phrase, it's maybe ridiculously heroic, is to argue that you need one strategy, and that for far too long we've segmented people and their issues as if they are different. Child poverty has actually become the 20th century way, because it was done the 20th century way of talking about the deserving poor. I have yet to meet a child who's poor in a wealthy family. Maybe it exists. But actually, what we're talking about is family poverty. When we talk about fuel poverty, we are talking about households without enough to pay their bills. When we're talking about older people who are older in poverty, we're talking about people whose working lives did not allow them enough scope. So the reason we've talked about a comprehensive approach to poverty is because I think part of the problem has been the way we've divided people up by population, by type of poverty, as if it was ever possible that you'd be in fuel poverty but not in some other sort of poverty. By and large, you're poor. And so what we've argued for is, and I'm looking at Anne-Marie here, who's doing a lot of the work for Joseph Rowntree Foundation on this, is a strategy that goes across the life cycle, that recognises that you have to intervene with children, both to enable their parents to work, but also to make sure that the next generation is not disadvantaged. An approach that recognises that the voices of people who are themselves poor are the most important voices in this discussion. And that while Joseph Rowntree Foundation and others could provide all the information that you want, actually those voices need to be heard. And then a really clear analysis of what makes governments move. What makes governments move is a sense that something can be done about it. And if, as in the past, I think too often we have talked about poverty as this overwhelming problem where we don't know what we should do, it has been very easy for governments to say, it's not our fault, it's their fault, it's the fault of Europe, it's the fault of Westminster. We can all play that game. In the meantime, people get poorer. And so what I'm interested in is generating a consensus that brings people from very different political perspectives together. And we may have to have some awkward conversations because we come with all our own baggage. That brings people who think of this as an issue for the individual alone, alongside people who recognise the labour market economics. Because anyone who has worked closely with people in poverty knows it's a false divide between the issue of, is this a structural issue or is this a personal issue? It's an issue that affects people and is dragging down our economy. And my final word, I think government listens when you address their priorities. And what's the priority for every government across the UK? It's making sure the return to growth is sustainable. And I can guarantee that if we carry on with the levels of poverty we currently have, we will never achieve a return to sustainable growth. That's the message we need to get across.
Okay. Over here.
Hi, I'm Michelle Crawford from Department for Social Development. I'd just be interested in your views, Julia, on the plans that were announced by the Conservative government to remove the focus on income-based measures and targets for child poverty, to replace those with an alternative focus on educational attainment and worklessness. So while those plans are specific to England, as I understand at the minute, the decision is yet to be taken in Northern Ireland. I'd be keen for your views on what the motivation is behind that and what impact you think that might have on future policy responses.
Well, I was lucky enough or unfortunate enough to have to go before the Welfare Reform Bill Committee on this. And what I said, I suppose I should say in public because it's probably on YouTube somewhere, is that what matters in government is what gets counted. And so if you stop counting something, you behave as if it doesn't matter. Counting the number of people in poverty matters, and it's something that my organisation will carry on doing. But we've never thought that simple income measures are the only thing you count. you count that, and you count everything else as well. So every year we publish our annual monitoring report, which uses government data, and it does give you the income data. And of course it tells you about worklessness, and of course it tells you about ill health, and of course it tells you about children who don't go to school. A basket of indicators is what gives you a full picture about poverty. Now, there's a very real and political cynicism that says, and I don't want to disagree with this, that once you've taken that off, you take attention away from it. We will say that we will keep our attention focused on those figures because they carry on mattering. But the sadness of it no longer being, in England at least, part of what government is measuring is it's therefore no longer part of what local government has to measure. And what matters is that local authorities, cities, regions, and the country as a whole have a really clear view of what's happening to the numbers. Because unless we do that, and I'll be the first to say we're talking about people, not numbers, but unless you measure it, you don't know what difference you're making. So I'm extremely sorry it's happened.
Kula, did you want to come in on this point?
Yeah, just to say... My understanding is of the proposed changes to the 2010 Child Poverty Act is unless we make a positive legislative effort in Northern Ireland, they will apply. It will apply here because it's a UK-wide piece of legislation. And I think I agree with you. Some of the stuff that was announced by Ian Duncan Smith isn't the end of the world, but they need to go, it needs to go together with the income, with the four measures that we have to measure child poverty, because it's tangible counting. The other thing is to remind everybody, not that this audience needs reminding, that is that we're 18 months behind in producing a child poverty action plan anyway. So whilst everybody else has got one and are or are not achieving it, we haven't got one yet. So I may have got it wrong around the Child Poverty Act, but I'm fairly sure. But I know I'm absolutely right that we don't have a Child Poverty Action Plan when we should have had one in April 2014.
Okay, there's a question here, and then I'll come down to the back.
Okay. My name's Heather Moorhead. I'm the director of the Northern Ireland Confederation for Health and Social Care in Northern Ireland, and I'm just... fantastic to hear the lecture, because we were just finishing off an election briefing for health and social care, and I think there's quite a lot of parallels. I come from a sustainable development background, as Claire and some of the other people in the audience, and I think this is much maybe something for comment for me, is that my experience is that when you divide things up, people start measuring their own thing. So let's measure education. I had a ridiculous conversation with somebody recently about food poverty or fuel poverty. What is it today? It's just a crazy way. And so we actually divide up the resources of government around people doing different things that reduce the outcome that we're looking for. So I'm wondering whether the place agenda, because people, when they live in place, they experience their world together, housing, education, environment, everything together. And I'm wondering if you think that... for hearts and minds and how we move in government, that actually that we can talk about it a lot, but what actually will make the difference? How do we act differently? How do we empower citizens? And do you think the place agenda is a bit of a solution for that?
I think a place or neighbourhood-based approach has lots of merits, but one of the great merits is that you can show it can be done, because me saying it's not inevitable doesn't look like anything. I'm really interested by... a local authority in London that said, we want to see what we could do to say no child will be on poverty in this housing estate. Now, normally we deal with problems on such a grand scale that we don't know how to do it. But if you know who the children are in poverty, we know the things that you can do. Their mothers are helped to work. We know that makes a difference. If there's very good nurseries, we know that makes a difference. You could do it and you could show it. We've just commissioned some work about neighbourhood level responses to poverty, which won't come out for a bit because research has never comes out as quickly as I want it to. But I think it's really important that we start focusing on where it matters, because people live in places, they live in neighbourhoods, they know their neighbours. You get far less in neighbourhoods of people talking about so-and-so's illegally claiming benefits. People know who's ill and who's able to work, they know who's really trying. They have that sort of interaction, and actually it's at neighbourhood level that people support each other. So I think place is an incredibly important way of looking at this. In its own right, but also, to go back to your question, as a way of saying to government, look, we can do some of this stuff. Not transformatively, it won't look wonderful immediately, but bit by bit we can make this a better place.
There was a question down at the back.
Yes. Good evening. Pierre Klein from Altogether in Dignity, 84th World Island in Dublin. From your position, you said that one element in all this picture is the issue of involving people who have the experience and the expertise about poverty as a life experience in different processes. You also know that we, as a small charity, we try to experiment this. But would you say that in the 15 past years, we made some progress, or do we still have really to create the spaces where, in different ways, where people who have this experience are partners, are in a certain way, I still believe that they are still missing in the picture as stakeholders strongly involved in the fight and recognized for their experience and their expertise.
Well, as you probably know, Joseph Rowntree Foundation does a lot of work with ADT Fourth World, and I should give a plug. There's a stall outside of stuff you must look at, because some of the work that you as an organisation have done in providing a platform for people's lived experience is incredibly important, and I'm very pleased that we've supported it. And Dan is here, who knows lots about it in detail. I think that we have to find more and better ways of enabling people to have their own voice. And I think that in public policy as a whole, we have done this very poorly over a very long period of time. There is no other bit of social policy which I can think of where we don't talk about people's rights to speak on their own behalf. And the work that you do and the work that the Poverty Truth Commissions do, which we also support, is a tiny glimmer of a way of starting to make progress on that. I think there are other glimmers. I think the way in which many people and organisations of people in poverty have used the internet and social media has actually provided a platform that simply didn't exist 5-10 years ago. If you follow Kalia Franklin and even Jack Monroe, who's now very famous for doing other things, they brought to life an experience that was too often expressed simply by professionals. But we're nowhere near where we need to be on it. And so therefore, I think encouragement and support to you and to your colleagues, but also to anyone else finding different ways of providing a platform for voices in a way that can redress the really toxic way in which poverty is so often currently described in the popular press. I'm also conscious I didn't answer your question about social health and social care, because one of the points I'd want to make in terms of what you're doing there is that social care, the caring economy, is part of an economic recovery. And yet it is the sector in which poverty is more locked in almost than anything else. And how we as a society treat the people who will care for us all and will put us all to bed in our old age really, really matters. And I think it's time we started seeing that as part of the caring economy, as part of the infrastructure for growth, just as much as roads and cranes are out here, because it's just as important.
Okay, I'm going to take another question here, and then I'm going to probably start to draw us to a conclusion. Thank you.
Malachy McKernan, representing the Society of St. Vincent de Paul. An organisation, I suppose, that has worked for almost 170 years here in Northern Ireland, addressing poverty issues, and begin to wonder if indeed the point that was made at the start, that poverty, the poor will always be with us, is true, or whether, Julia, as you say, we can and we will get rid of poverty. Certainly from our society's point of view, the mountain seems to be getting higher in recent years, and we've locally taken a keen interest in the social justice dimension of that. As well as helping those who are in poverty. But, of course, we know that at present there are the others who have been mentioned, the Trussell Trust, yourselves, we find the information and reports that Joseph Rowntree Trust Foundation brings forward are very, very useful indeed. But in all of this, I suppose, what I'm coming to is that if we are to succeed in doing away with this, is there some way that your views on how all of the various organisations can maybe work better together. And we have the Law Centre now, of course, so, you know, from the legal aspect of it, there's some ways that can help. But can we combine all our respective work on this in some way better so to be more effective in doing that? Just was interested in your views on that, Julia.
Well, I'm not going to volunteer any organisation to coordinate because that's not my place. But you are right that all of us in what I would broadly call civil society have, I think, for too long allowed the differences between us and our own special boundaries to get in the way of us actually doing anything. And we're very good, aren't we, in the voluntary sector, particularly at policing the differences between us, instead of saying we have a common cause here. If this is the organising purpose, I'm absolutely clear no progress can be made without governments involved, of course. But without voluntary and community and church-based organisations signing up to it and making sure that you do some things differently. You will do it with differences between you, of course. There are all sorts of different approaches that need to be applied. But a sense of purpose and a sense of drive. Because, and I hate to... I worry always about quoting from the New Testament because I'll get it wrong. I don't actually think the words of the poor will always be with us. You will always have the poor with you. Therefore, pay attention to me while I'm here, was the quote. Actually, poor people will always require your attention. Poverty doesn't need to stay with us forever.
Well, on that note, I am going to draw us to a close. The Law Centre does clearly, we're a law centre, we believe in the power of using the law to achieve social change, but that is done best and most powerfully when we all work in partnership and in concert towards that common goal. Julia has talked about the importance of voice, the importance of the hard statistical evidence, and so the Welfare Reform and Work Bill is of great concern to all of us in this room. The importance of the range of actors that need to come to this table behind that organising purpose to achieve that new, strong and just social settlement that Julia has talked about. And what I think I'm going away with tonight is the possibility of opportunities ahead. We are a creative bunch. Nothing is beyond us, at least that's what I tell my children. And I opened my introduction to this session with Julia's words that poverty is real and it is damaging and it is not inevitable. And I think they are the words to close tonight's lecture. I'd like to thank you all for your passion and your commitment to this work. I'd like to thank you for joining us, and I'd like to now invite you to join us for a cup of tea and a piece of shortbread. And finally, to thank all my colleagues and those involved in the organising of this event, and including Joseph Rowntree Foundation. Thank you all very much indeed.